Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the third Democratic debate. Last night in Texas, we got to see the 10 top candidates share the stage for the first time.
The Democratic primary debate starts right now.
They discussed health care.
The richest individuals and the biggest corporations are going to pay more, and middle-class families are going to pay less.
Guns?
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
And even fielded a few questions about foreign policy.
I remember President Trump scoffed and said he'd like to see me making a deal with Xi Jinping. I'd like to see him making a deal with Xi Jinping.
Edward Isaac Daubert is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He was in Houston to watch the candidates square off and join me to talk about what, if anything, we learned and how the debate set the stage for a new phase of the campaign. Isaac Daubert, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
The primary has been reported as kind of a battle between the moderate and progressive wings of the party. What did you see last night? How did you feel about what you saw last night?
Well, some of it is about the ideological divisions in the party, what to do about healthcare, how much one should trust corporations like insurance companies to run things versus the government running things. And some of it is about a posture of aggressiveness and how much to look at what happened with the election of Donald Trump as the start of a new way of doing things, a more combative way of doing things. And some of it is about perspective, the difference of a generational shift that would come if the nominee is not Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders, and even if not Elizabeth Warren, who is a little bit younger than Biden and Sanders, but is 70 herself. And you see that contrast to the rest of the field, essentially, when you've got Pete Buttigieg, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, Beto O'Rourke, each of them trying to establish themselves as the new voice of a newer party.
You know, it was so interesting because people kept thinking that last night was going to be this great sort of clash between Warren and Biden, and yet that's not what really happened.
It's not, and part of the reason why people thought it would happen is because Biden's aides spent the earlier part of the week saying that it would happen. Another part of the reason is because to date, even though we've had four nights of debates, the way the random drawing went, when there were two nights in Miami and two nights in Detroit, Warren and Biden ended up on separate stages. So this is the first time in this debate that they have been next to each other. And with the dynamics of the race, what they are, it looked like maybe that's the setup for a confrontation. And then Biden's team, as I said, leaned into that idea. Biden himself never really delivered on that. A couple of times he tried to, but mostly it was in his first answer about healthcare when he said that Warren is with Bernie Sanders, and he's with Barack Obama, defending Obamacare, which of course is interesting in itself because Barack Obama has said that he thinks Medicare for All is a good idea.
It was interesting. Joe Biden seemed more energetic, more on top of his game. It would seem as though there's been lots of rehearsing going on. Would you agree?
Oh, these candidates spend days and weeks in preparation for hours. One campaign told me that the day before the debate, they had 6 hours of debate prep, and then another two or three on the day of the debate. And that's just in that final stretch. But this has been going on for them for a long time and in a nonstop way. Also, they're, through what they're doing on the campaign trail, rehearsing, obviously, there were, I can tell you, Diane, from being out on the campaign trail and hearing these people make their pitches all the time, a lot of the lines were pretty familiar to me.
So how solid do you think Biden's performance was? People say it's his nomination to lose. Did he do anything to shake that image last night?
I don't think that we should have ever expect or should ever expect that one debate will change the fundamental dynamics of a race. Biden has been in this secure but not strong spot as the front runner. He has got 30-ish percent points in every poll. That means that 70% of people are saying they want someone else. That may be enough for him to get over the line in the nomination. But I'll tell you, from talking to people out in the early states, in Iowa, in New Hampshire, where I was last weekend, what consistently comes up is the response from voters that say, well, this one's in my top three or in my top four. I'm not really sure yet. Biden has more people who seem like they are with him, most of them because they're just essentially terrified of Donald Trump winning re-election and think that more people are going to vote for Biden, and so they're going to vote for Biden. But it's certainly not secure yet, and we are about 4.5 months from the Iowa caucuses, about 5.5 months then from the Super Tuesday day at the beginning of March that will probably be what determines who the nominee is. And there are a lot of twists and turns that this race will probably take. Few of them seem to be on the debate stage.
What would you say are the insecurities that people talk about? Is it Biden's age? Is it his few stumbles that he's made in debates past? Is it what he had to say about slavery last night, which got pretty muddled? What do the voters you've talked to say?
It's all of those things. It's connected to age. People say something like, his time may have passed, or I just want something fresh, which is about his age, but also about how long he's been on the public stage. He was elected to the Senate in 1972. He's been a national figure since the late 70s, early 80s, when people started to get to know him. He first thought about running for president in 1984. He tried to run for president in 1988. He thought about it a bunch of other times, did run in 2008, thought about it again in 2015 for the 16 race, didn't, and now ran it. So it's, depending on how you count, six-ish presidential cycles that have included Joe Biden. That just wears on people over time. It also, though, to his benefit, creates a level of familiarity and personal connection that people feel with him that goes deeper than any of the other candidates can hope to. And whether that carries him through in the end, we will see.
Yeah, and what about his responses on slavery last night?
If you are looking for Joe Biden to have crisp, clear answers on many issues that are outside of his direct wheelhouse, then you're not going to get it. And that is part of what to Biden's campaign aides is his appeal, that he's being real and talking about things. There was a briefing that three of his campaign aides did right before the debate in Houston, and we could only talk about them as campaign officials or campaign aides, whatever they said. But one of them said, yeah, he gets dates wrong and he gets details wrong and he gets places and names wrong. But people feel like he's the real Joe Biden. He's just talking about things. And so, you know, that can lead him into that answer on slavery. It also can lead him into what, when he said that he wanted to divide Afghanistan into three parts, he was really, I think, talking about his old plan to divide Iraq into three parts. But if people want Joe Biden, then they know what they're getting. And what they're getting is somebody who speaks in that way.
It was interesting in the earlier debates, you had the other candidates criticizing Barack Obama and some of his policies. We didn't hear that so much last night.
Part of what happened was that second debate in Detroit in July, which is when Biden was on stage and other candidates seemed to be taking some issue with the Obama-era policies. And Biden then afterwards tried to make this, well, I'm the one standing up for Obama and I don't know what these other people are doing. The other candidates were, of course, sensitive to that and didn't want to fall into that trap again. even as Biden himself has distanced himself from some parts of the Obama record, and in the debate on Thursday could not answer the question about deportations in a way that he thought would work. And so he just at that point said, well, I was the vice president, instead of the way that he has talked about the Obama record to date, which is the Obama-Biden record, as if he is an equal partner in it. And he was the vice president. He was an advisor to Barack Obama, but he was not an equal partner in the Obama administration. And everybody knows that. It does make for a pretty good campaign pitch, though.
I must say, Beto O'Rourke stood out last night with his comments about AR-15s and AK-47s. Do you think he gained ground last night?
I spent a lot of time in the last week and a half with Beto O'Rourke, and there is certainly a change in him that came from that El Paso shooting. El Paso means a lot to him. He sort of defines himself by his hometown. He said to me that he did not see what was going on in the country in the way that he does now before the shooting. You can look at that and say it took a shooting in your hometown to open your eyes to all these things that now you think are so terrible. But one way or the other, he is in a different place mentally, psychologically, about himself and about the race. That this debate took place in Texas made it so that he was on ground where people wanted to hear about the shooting and are still thinking about the shooting, and of course the second shooting that happened at the end of August. And it meant that because it was only about 5 weeks ago, it's still very fresh in people's minds, so that he kept on getting turned to, not just by the moderators, but by other candidates, to say, we really appreciated what you said about the shooting and how you've responded to it. That gave him a real opportunity to stand out.
Do you think that moved him forward in terms of his standing among all those candidates?
Well, we'll see. There are things that he has talked about that are probably legislatively impossible, like trying to do mandatory buybacks of assault rifles. But what he wants is for people to hear the level of crisis that he sees in America, and that they should feel it with him, and that they should feel connected to someone who is ready to call it out.
He was very passionate, I must say, and came across more strongly than I've ever seen him up to now.
I can tell you that from talking with his campaign aides while the debate was going on and then afterwards, they were quite happy with how he came across. Beto O'Rourke is a gifted public speaker, but he is a bad debater. He was a bad debater going up against Ted Cruz in the Senate race last year in Texas. Ted Cruz is a skilled debater going back to his high school and college days. And Beto O'Rourke is just not suited really to the debate stage in the way that he talks and the way that he tries to get his points across. But there is no question that in this third debate, he really did find a way to channel a lot of what he's been saying in much more narrative butterfly strokes that he tends to speak in into directed answers on that stage.
You know, that brings me to the question of what happens now. Last night you had 10 candidates on the stage because of the Democratic National Committee rules. After last night, are they going to move to reduce that number again for the October debates?
So the rules that were set up is that the qualifications, the criteria for the September debate and the October debate are the same. So everybody who is on stage in Houston will be on stage in the next debate, which is in Ohio, right after Columbus Day. Additionally, Tom Steyer, the billionaire activist, has qualified for that debate. So now that is 11 candidates. And it does seem like there's a pretty good chance that Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, will qualify. Mathematically, the likelihood that one of the other candidates will qualify in between now and then is pretty low. But what that means is that we could end up in October with two nights of debate again. And then for November and December and January, those thresholds will be moved up.
surely those candidates, as well as I, are going to have to worry about the public just getting so weary of these debates without really understanding who might be the best candidate to take on Donald Trump.
That is definitely the case, and we are into, I think, 13 hours of debates already between the two nights each in Miami and Detroit for the first two debates, and then this debate in Houston. There is this big question of how much stamina the audience has for
this. Yeah, exactly. Well, now let's talk about foreign policy, Isaac, and what you think we learned last night about the various candidate stances on that issue.
Joe Biden obviously has the most experience in the race on foreign policy, but saying the most, it's not even really a comparison. The other candidates in the race don't have foreign policy experience for the most part. Kamala Harris has served on the Homeland Security Committee and the Intelligence Committee in the Senate for the last 2 years since she got to the Senate. Elizabeth Warren cited her trip to Iraq with John McCain in 2017. And I think they were there for about a day, and it was 2.5 years ago. So if you're talking about experience dealing with these things, then there's not a whole lot of it. And then it goes back from that. It drops off then precipitously to like Pete Buttigieg, who served in the military in Afghanistan. And then it becomes about people's ideas about what to do. And one might be able to say that Joe Biden saying, I've met Nicolas Maduro and I've confronted him, is not as significant an issue as Biden would like it to be. And you go back and think about the way that Barack Obama, when he was running, was criticized for not knowing any foreign leaders or having any foreign policy experience. He had been sitting in Springfield, Illinois in the state Senate, but he put himself forward as the person who had a new perspective on the 21st century and America's role in the world. And obviously that worked. He was elected, even though throughout the race it came up as big problems for him. You know, if you go back and think, and don't remember if it was still in 2007 or in 2008, but in one of the primary debates, Obama got in trouble for saying he would meet with Iran and he'd be willing to, and Hillary Clinton beat him up quite a bit for that, as did many other people. But that did precipitate the kind of foreign policy approach that he had, where he was willing to sit down and talk with people, opened up relations with Cuba, was able to get the Iran deal forward. So it's up to the candidates who are not Joe Biden to say, yeah, having experience is great, but we're looking for something else.
What about China?
Well, that becomes an issue that is about foreign policy, but also about domestic economics, because the way that it played out in the debate and that it's playing out so far largely politically because of what President Trump has been doing is via the trade war, and whether there will be a removal of the tariffs that President Trump has put in and has promised to put in more of. And so that becomes somewhat about what kind of relationship you have with Beijing, but also how are you going to address what's going on with farmers, and how are you going to address what happens when jobs are continuing to move overseas from the United States because the labor standards and wages are lower overseas. And none of the candidates has so far been able to answer exactly what they would do. Hmm. They've said what they wouldn't do. I think it's striking that of the 25 candidates that were running, there was only one who was willing to stand by the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal that Barack Obama had made a priority for the end of his presidency, that would have connected the United States with 11 other countries around the Pacific, Canada, South America, and Asia, and had a sort of NAFTA-like agreement. It was NAFTA-like, but there were much stronger standards and much higher standards for labor and wages and things of that sort. Joe Biden campaigned on behalf of that deal and has since said he doesn't like that deal anymore. For all the things that he says he wants to do exactly like Barack Obama, that's not one of them. So the only candidate who stood by it is John Delaney, the former congressman from Maryland, who has not really been much of a factor in the race so far. that's what he would do. Other candidates, I'm not sure exactly what they would do on trade and how they would deal with China, except to not deal with it the way that Donald Trump has. That was part of what Pete Buttigieg said, that Trump had criticized him for not being able to make a deal with China. But Buttigieg said, but I have seen that Trump hasn't been able to make a deal with China either.
A short break. When we come back, more from Edward Isaac de Vere.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
Decius Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
Decius Daily.
Sign up at decius.com/newsletter.
decius.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with Edward Isaac de Vere. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and host of Radio Atlantic podcast. We haven't talked much about Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. How well did they stand out last night or not?
Well, Bernie Sanders is somewhat like Joe Biden in that you know what you're getting with Bernie Sanders. He is the most consistent person on stage, and he is one of the most consistent people in national politics. Now, that doesn't mean that people necessarily like what he has to say, but he has been saying it for the most part nonstop for the last 50 years that he's been running for office or in office. And there is no question that he has shaped or reshaped what the Democratic Party thinks about, especially around healthcare, but around other issues as well that came out from his 2016 campaign. That goes to the discussion about free college or what to do about student debt. All those things Sanders kind of put into the bloodstream of the Democratic Party, and now it's about the antibodies in the bloodstream trying to figure out whether they're going to accept it. And that's where Sanders stands. With Warren, she has continued to be there in the race, and I think that that's important. She's built herself up organically from an earlier part in the race where she was doing really badly, and now is just a presence in it. There is no way to think about this race going forward where Warren is not a defining factor in it. And when I talk to people on the ground sort of the grassroots and the grass tops, the operative class, the power players in the Democratic Party, most of them think right now that she is the odds-on favorite to be the nominee.
Say that again, Isaac.
When I talk to people, whether they're Democratic activists or people showing up at events or people who are in leadership positions in the party, there is this sense that she will be the nominee. She is the odds-on favorite to be the nominee, even as Biden continues to lead. Now, of course, statistically, Biden has been ahead of her in every poll, I think, with maybe one or two exceptions, and ahead of her not by a point or two in most of them, but by more than that. But what that will look like as people get more serious about this race and think more about Biden, and also, importantly, as the organizational part of this really comes into play, and it's not about who do you like and who have you heard of, but more about campaigns activating their voters, getting them to vote. When that comes to the Iowa caucuses especially, that's essential, but that will continue to be a big thing through those early states, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, and then setting things up for that Super Tuesday at the beginning of March of next year, when there is going to be a massive nationwide campaign, essentially, that goes on that includes California, Texas, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Minnesota. It's all over the place. It's going to be a huge operation. It basically will be a dry run for running a general election campaign.
I'm so fascinated that these high-level Democratic operatives think that Elizabeth Warren will end up at the top of the ticket. What about a Biden-Warren ticket. I mean, does anybody think in those terms?
I think we're a little bit premature for people putting together tickets. Joe Biden himself tried to convince Elizabeth Warren to be his running mate out of the gate if he had run in 2016. They had this meeting in 2015 where that was essentially his pitch, and she didn't bite. Of course, he didn't end up running then. So maybe we'll come back to that, but we've got a lot of room to go
figure
out what the ticket looks like.
Exactly. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about, David Leonhardt wrote in the New York Times that all these Democrats are not focusing sufficiently on Trump and Trump's failures, that they are not attacking him sufficiently. What's your take on that?
And different people have different opinions on this. It can't be all about Trump. It has to be all about Trump. You have to talk about Trump as a symptom. You have to talk about Trump as the cause. And so I think depending on the voter, depending on the strategist, depending on the focus group that you're doing, depending on the analyst, that is what the conversation ends up being guided by. But there is certainly not one sense of this. I hear people say that they don't want to hear about Trump anymore, and also that watch that almost every time every candidate gives a speech, the biggest applause lines are the ones where they take a dig at Trump.
And Trump, of course, has already begun to talk about 2024.
He started talking about running for re-election while he was in the transition period. Before he was inaugurated, he said his 2016 slogan was Make America Great, and his 2020 slogan would be Keep America Great, which essentially meant that he was saying that just by electing him, America was greater. And sure enough, that's the re-election slogan that they've been using, Keep America Great.
As this debate was going on last night, he was speaking to Republicans in Baltimore saying, if Democrats are elected, the country will go to hell.
Yeah, and this is what I think we'll see much more of over the course of the next year. It's not really a surprise at this point. And of course, it came a couple of hours after he said he had respect for everybody running. And then even in that same speech in Baltimore, called a couple people by nicknames or talked about them dismissively. So that's who Donald Trump is. And anybody who doesn't know who Donald Trump is at this point hasn't been paying attention to almost anything since he is part of every part of American thought and culture at this point. So when people go to vote, they will know what they are voting for if they vote for Donald Trump. If they're driven by voting against him, they'll certainly know what they're voting against with voting against Donald Trump.
Isaac, I know you've been busy on this debate this week, but we also had an election in North Carolina, a special election. What do the results tell us about 2020, if anything?
Well, they say a couple of things. It's a district that Donald Trump won comfortably and that then was a dogfight into the end. And so that would seem to say that the Democrats are moving into a stronger position in a lot of places that you wouldn't have thought that they are strong. That said, of course, the Republican won, and moving into a stronger position is all nice and dandy, but it matters who wins these elections, and the Republicans still won.
I know you're in the middle of writing a book with the subtitle, Democrats in Crisis in the Trump Years. Tell us what your definition of crisis is.
It's many things. It's an existential crisis. It's an electoral crisis. It's a crisis of confidence in themselves and what they thought the country would be. Then it's a crisis about having all those crises.
Is anything you're hearing so far in these debates going to change that?
Well, so far, it's still the growing pains of what this party is maybe becoming. and we will see over the course of, we've got 9 more debates ahead of us, what this looks like. But more importantly than the debates, the 5 months of the campaign until we likely get to a nominee, and then what happens forward from that? Of course, when Hillary Clinton beat Bernie Sanders for the nomination, the party could not sort out what it was and could not come together. Even as Bernie Sanders tried to tell people, vote for Hillary Clinton, there was just a resistance to it and a thought that she was not connected with where politics are. It matters in that respect who wins the nomination, and it matters what happens with all the other elements of the party around it.
Well, if you had to say now what you believe the Democratic Party is becoming, what would that be?
I think we're still getting the answer to that question. And I do think that one of the things that has happened with Trump is that it's been a very clarifying thing for many people in politics, because he is so clearly one position on an issue that he has made it. If you don't agree with him, then at least you know where you are, roughly. And then it's about what you do with that. And that has changed what voters look like, where the allegiances are. You have, over the course of American political history, certain elections that change what the makeup of an electorate is. The 1964 election, after Lyndon Johnson was moving on civil rights legislation, the 1994 election, when you had Democrats who were in the South actually move and become the Republicans that they always were, and Republicans in the Northeast over time finish moving into being the Democrats that they always were. And it seems like 2016 might have been the beginning of a new pathway in that.
Final question. Do you think that these debates are really the way to help voters learn more about each of these candidates and to define what it is they want to see moving forward?
I think it's an excellent question, Diane, and it is pretty obvious that the answer is no. That they so far have not been so illuminating, and how could they be? But they have taken on this outsized importance in this race already because of who makes the stage and who doesn't.
Yeah.
And that will continue to be the case.
What would be a better way?
That I'm not sure. That's sort of what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Is this like the Winston Churchill line about democracy?
Right. It's too bad because there is so much that we as voters need to know before we go to the polls. And I'm not sure that these debates are really giving us that understanding. I just wish somebody could figure out a better way. Maybe that's your next task.
I'll take it under advisement that I have to sort out what happens for the Democratic Party or for the Republican Party at this point to figure out how to explain itself better.
Indeed. Isaac, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dan.
That's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email. drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Yurib-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.